This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Books in African Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Elisa Prosperetti. Today, I will be talking to Professor François-Xavier Fauvel about his book, The Golden Rhinoceros, Histories of the African Middle Ages. The Golden Rhinoceros was published in English translation in 2018 by Princeton University Press, although the French version was published in 2013. Both of these are prize-winning books. The French version won the Grand Prix de Rendez-vous de l'Histoire, which recognizes a French language book that has contributed significantly to advancing historical knowledge for the greater public. And the English version won the Medieval Book of the Year Award in 2018. A few words about our guest. François-Xavier is a historian and archaeologist of Africa. He holds the first permanent chair in African history at the prestigious Collège de France, for which he delivered his inaugural lecture in October 2019. In addition to his position at the Collège, François-Xavier is based at the Trace Laboratory at the University Toulouse-Jean Jaurès. His research interests are unusually wide-ranging. He has conducted extensive fieldwork in South Africa, Ethiopia, and Morocco, and published on many periods of African history, from the ancient to the contemporary to, as we will be discussing today, the African Middle Ages. François-Xavier, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Elisa.
So why don't we begin by introducing yourself to our listeners? Tell us a little about yourself. How did you become a historian of Africa?
Well, that's a long story. And I started actually by doing studies in philosophy, and I started the university as a student in philosophy. I even went as far as starting a PhD dissertation, which I stopped after a year. And then after a couple of years, I eventually found that I was interested in Africa, in history, in archaeology. But all these things did not reconcile well, in the sense that there was no place where I could basically do in France archaeology related to Africa and history, etc. So I started a new master thesis and then a PhD dissertation in African history, modern African history, at the University of Sorbonne, and it was on the representation of the Khoisan people in Western literature, in Portuguese, Dutch, French, English, from the 15th to the 19th century. And meanwhile, I did my first field missions in Southern Africa, and I became more and more interested in ancient African history. I mean, what I mean, the African history before there were a lot of written sources in Western languages. And then, guided by this frustration about modern history, I became more and more interested into more ancient African history. That's how I became, I trained as an archaeologist on different fields with different people, with different team. And then I accepted the position of director of the French Center for Ethiopian Studies in Addis Ababa, where I lived 3 years. And then I moved from there to other places. I directed excavations in Morocco, etc. And so step by step, guided by frustration about what I was doing, and I eventually created my own way, if I can say this, you know, and became a historian of ancient Africa and at the same time an archaeologist.
Well, I think it's certainly very comforting for everyone out there to know that it takes a few tries to really find your way. But certainly,
yes,
this book has
and failures and many failures. But it's a story, as you it's a story of opportunities and failures, and step by step, I eventually managed to construct something. So it was not a given from the start, for sure.
Yeah, it's a story of research. You know, being driven by a question.
Absolutely.
So this book, The Golden Rhinoceros, African Middle Ages, you begin by kind of bringing to us, the reader, this paradox about this period, the African Middle Ages. And this paradox, you say, is one in which we have a golden age in Africa, literally and figuratively. And you ask, how could this period that is so radiant be obscured so much in the surviving documentation? This paradox of radiance and yet this lack of documentation, which is the question that drove you to get to this project. So I wonder if you could kind of unravel for us more, with a little bit more detail, this paradox between the golden age and yet our lack of knowledge about this golden age.
Yeah, it is true that Africa and different regions of Africa participated to this global phenomenon that can be labeled the Middle Ages, and that's how I frame my perception of the place of Africa during the Middle Ages. In other words, you know, there is no reason why the word Middle Ages should belong to Europe or to any other part of the world. I tend to see the Middle Ages as a global process of a certain type of interconnections with between different regions, a certain role of merchants in interconnecting these regions, the role of the Islamic world as an interface, as a political and economical platform of between the different provinces of the medieval world, and that's the framework behind the way how I conceived the golden rhinoceros. So for me, there is no doubt about it. And Africa and Africa's, I should say, different regions of Africa participated in this global process. But now you're right. The question is, why is it that we don't know much about it? And there are several reasons for this. I mean, one is an ideological one. There is generally speaking a lack of knowledge about ancient Africa, and not that there are no sources, but because there is a lack of interest in the public or in the funding institutions or in the higher education institutions, etc. about ancient Africa in general. But also, there is also a certain regimen of documentation, and which I think is a specificity of African history. In many cases, we don't have written sources produced by the very societies we are talking about. And so if one compares with Europe, Christian Latin Europe, which produced its own written sources, most historians work on these written sources, and when they need, they can add up to these written sources produced by Western Christian Latin societies other kind of sources, such as external written sources or archaeology, etc. But the main body of knowledge and scholarship created about Europe is based on sources produced by European societies. This is not the case in Africa, except in a few exceptions like Ethiopia. But for most of the societies we are talking about, for instance, Mali in the 14th century, or Zimbabwe in the 14th century, or the Kingdom of Kanem in the 11th century, or the Kingdom of Ghana in the 11th century, we don't have sources written from the inside of these societies. And that makes a big difference. That makes a big documentary difference, but that makes also a big narrative difference. And these documentary gaps and narrative discontinuity we have to fill, we have to correct, and we have to reconstruct a narrative. How do we do this? We do this with piecemeal of other documents, which can be written sources produced from the outside by visitors or by diplomats. We can fill this up or correct this gap by archaeology, by findings, by objects in museums, by historical linguistics, by a number of, or sometimes by also a few written documents that have survived, etc. So the only possible way we can work on ancient African history is by putting together a number of highly heterogeneous pieces that do not fit well together. And we have to work with it. So some people might say, this is less than history. This is not real history. This is less interesting. For my part, I say, well, it's much more challenging, and so it is much more interesting. And in a way, it's history par excellence. And that's why I like so much this job of African history. And that's also why so many people, so many colleagues not working on Africa, and such a large audience also like it. There is something like an investigation, in the past.
And that's very much the approach that you take in this book. You investigate with the full force of the skills you have as a historian, as an archaeologist, even as a philosopher of history, to try to take objects or archaeological sites or written sources and to go into them layer by layer with us alongside for the ride to try to see what we can know.
Yes, absolutely. You're right. And I mean, part of what I'm doing in these books is also to accept the particular discomfort of being a historian of ancient Africa, and to accept that what many people can perceive as a liability, as something less than history, is actually exactly what history is. And what I like is that the problem of having few sources, the problem of having sources that do not reconcile well, the problem of having just tiny windows and not a continuous narrative, these problems become the very topic of the stories I want to tell.
And to further complicate this challenge, you say, as you're laying out this paradox of lack of documentation and yet this golden age, that it's not simply that we don't have written sources that are produced internal to the societies that we're interested in looking at. We're also coming off of several hundred years of what you call this coercion underneath the land, but also, of course, above the surface of the land with the history of colonialism, and also particularly its effects on material culture and material remains. Can you unpack that a little bit?
Yes, absolutely. And so many layers of time have accumulated between the past of ancient African societies and today. Well, in a way, it's true anywhere on Earth, but it's all the more true in Africa, and for different reasons. Because not only did time pass, but also a number of erasing processes took place. And of course, yes, colonialism was one of them, and looting was one of them. And negation of history is also one of them. And there is a process of oblivion that compounds the problem of accessing the past in Africa, and that makes things all the more complicated. I mean, it is fascinating and very frustrating that there are some major sites are still missing, you know. And I can give you the example of the once very famous capital of the Kingdom of Mali in the 14th century. Okay, this is a place that was described by the famous historian Ibn Khaldun. It was described by the famous Mamluk chronicler Al-Umari. It was even described by the traveler who lived there, okay, for 8 to 9 months, Ibn Battuta. But we don't know where this capital was. And how is it possible? I mean, can you imagine the capital of a European kingdom that would disappear like this, to the point that we don't know where it is? Okay. And how can it disappear? Is it just that it was, you know, overflowed by a river, or that it was what really happened? Or is it just that we don't know where to look at? Or what? How can a major place like this just disappear? Of course, it does not technically disappear. It's just that we don't know where it is. We don't know how to look. We don't know to which source we should rely on, but that I find this absolutely fascinating, that places belonging to time just separated from us by a few centuries can just disappear like this. And I could give you many examples of this. I can give you another example in Ethiopia, and with the capital of Ifat, also a 14th to 15th century Muslim sultanate, that had disappeared. And we were able, with colleagues of mine 10 years ago, to discover the capital of this sultanate. And it was in a region that where actually no one could think that the capital would be there, because it was just 20 kilometers from the Christian kingdom. And our first reflex was to look far to the east, you know, hundreds of kilometers afar, and we visited there, and we found many other places of minor interest, etc., but no capital. And then eventually, that's when we changed our mind, and we visited other landscapes, and we were able to find, after a number of failures, we were able to find this this capital of Ifat. But in the case of the capital of Mali, I mean, no one has been able to find where this capital was. So there are many places like this. There are many orphan names in Arabic sources of the Middle Ages that we don't know where they were. These kind of mysteries I find absolutely fascinating. Not because I am a romantic archaeologist and, you know, kind of Indiana Jones would like to discover unknown places, but because it emphasizes the very nature of the regimen of documentation that the African past is, and the kind of investigation that our work of historian consists in. I find this extremely interesting to do, and if only because it's extremely challenging. It is very, very, very challenging intellectually and methodologically.
Well, I think in some ways that how challenging it is, it comes out of course, in some, you know, great tragedy, but at the same time, it's very humbling, which is an important corrective to certain ways that history has been written in the past. And you have this lovely metaphor to kind of distill this when you say that you've preferred the stained glass window to the grand narrative fresco that would have produced only the illusion of an authoritative discourse. And this use of the metaphor stained glass, of course, is very effective in that it immediately brings to mind kind of the European High Middle Ages and Orients, maybe Eurocentric audience who's picked up the book to have perhaps that image. But it's also much more than that, because you explicitly state in the beginning of this book that you are rejecting an implicit pressure in academic publishing to present the authoritative discourse, the one that is utterly complete. And I wondered if this was not only something that the research process and the writing process brought you to, but also a way of unlearning or thinking about the practice of history that you personally had to reckon with.
Yes, absolutely. I like this metaphor, you know, of the stained glass. Not because it attracts the attention, you know, to the cathedrals or whatever. It's not what I am interested in. What I like is that a stained glass is made of a number of fragments, and that are pasted together by lead, you know, and you do not pretend that the pieces of glass fit together, and on the contrary, you make the lead all the more apparent. And that's what I want to do in this. That's what I wanted to do in this book. I mean, the story we can tell is a story made of fragments. And instead of lying to the reader by drawing a continuous narrative whereby you would just paste the fragment as if it was the original image, by lying about the fact that they are fragments. Instead of this, I want to have these thick pieces of lead, you know, that are both that do not hide the fact that these are fragments, and at the same time that connect the fragments with one another. So what I like is the joint, you know, between these fragment of glasses, and by pasting together these fragments, you create an image which is an imperfect image, and where the joint is as important as the pieces of glass. Why is it so important to show that the lead joint is there? Because the way how you historian reconstruct the past is just one possibility. There are other possibilities, and you can, and based on these fragments, you can tell many different stories. And the many different stories you can tell to the reader is part of the story. And if I were to tell the story in a grand narrative way, that would be probably more satisfying to some reader, but that would also be lying. Lying because it is not true that we can, that we must tell the story that one way, you know? And let me give you an example. The kingdom of Ghana, okay? The ancient kingdom of Ghana, which is not modern Ghana, you know, and which is the medieval kingdom of Ghana was in the south of today's Mauritania. We have two major fragments. One is provided by an Andalusian Arab writer, Al-Bakri, in the mid-11th century, and one is provided a century later by the famous Arab cartographer Al-Idrisi. Okay, these are the two main windows, and we have other tiny fragments, but these are the two major fragments that we have, a century apart. Okay, nothing before, nothing in the middle, almost nothing after. Okay, and the problem is that these two pieces do not reconcile well. It does not reconcile well at all. Okay, and why? Because the first one says that the kingdom of Ghana is situated in a plain, okay, and that he gives the name of the plain, okay, so that fits well with an archaeological site that we know in South Mauritania, in what is today in the desert, etc. He said that the kingdom is pagan, okay, and then a century later, Idrisi goes on to say that the kingdom of Ghana is Muslim. So, okay, so we understand that something like a conversion occurred in the meantime. Okay, we don't have the detail because we don't have a continuous narration, but we guess that there was a dynastic change, or maybe just a conversion of the dynasty, and that's okay. But then he goes on and he says that a river passed in the middle of the city. But, you know, there is no way that there was a river in the region that was described by Al-Bakri a century earlier. There is no way. So not only did something happen, a dynastic change or a conversion of the dynasty, but what? But did the capital move a few hundred kilometers toward a river? But that's a major change, you know? And what if one of the two writers was just wrong? No, what if Al-Idrisi was just confusing the kingdom of Ghana with another one? Or what if Al-Bakri was wrong? So basically, we cannot be sure that they are talking of the same thing, you know, of the same kingdom. If everything else has changed, you know, the religion, the place, the city, and the dynasty, I mean, what is left? What is left of the kingdom of Ghana? So we can make the hypothesis that one of them is wrong, but which one should we preserve? You know, and we can make also the hypothesis that the two are right, you know, but in that case, we should decide that there is something wrong in the very heart of the description of one or another. So we can, the only thing we can make is choose the hypothesis that we want, to favor. But we cannot not tell it to the reader. Okay. And so what I think I must do as a historian is just list the problems and create a landscape of problems and give to the reader the elements in my possession, you know, to think about the problems that the Kingdom of Ghana is. And that's what I'm doing in a number of chapters in this book. I cannot choose, and I still cannot choose now. I have different hypotheses. I can just expose these different hypotheses, and so that's why this fragmentary documentary regimen of African history, I have no choice but to narrate it in a fragmentary way. Hence the metaphor of the stained glass.
So where does oral tradition come in to this source landscape?
That's a very good question. That's a very good and very complex question. I am a big fan of oral tradition. But at the same time, I have to recognize that there is also in the public an alternance of naivete or distrust about oral tradition in Africa. Most people don't know what oral tradition is, or confuse oral tradition with just, you know, oral information or etc. And oral tradition are a real thing, and they are a real historical tool to reconstruct the past. But what I think is that they are very useful to reconstruct things that happened during the last two or three or four centuries. They must be used in a critical way, like any other historical material, like archaeology or like a written source. There is no problem. This oral tradition are a real historical source, but they cannot be used to reconstruct things that happened, you know, 1,000 years ago. It's useless to reconstruct things that happened 1,000 years ago. It cannot go that far back. And all researchers, all historians who have worked on oral tradition show that there is a kind of ceiling, you know, around the 16th or 17th century, and that oral tradition cannot go through this ceiling. You can tell me, okay, but what about the epic of Sunjata in the Malinke and the world in West Africa? Yes, I mean, this is an epic, and this is an epic that is extremely interesting, that narrates the creation of the Empire of Mali, an event that most historians agree took place around the 13th century. But it is an epic, and although it encapsulates, you know, big events and that really took place, and a historical figure like Sunjata that did exist. What else is true in this epic? You know? And I'm obliged to say not much. And that would be, you know, it is as difficult to reconstruct the events of the creation of the Empire of Mali based on the Epicum Sunjata as it is to reconstruct the Carolingian, the creation of the Carolingian Empire in the 8th century, based on 12th or 13th century chanson de geste in French. I mean, you cannot reconstruct things that belong to such a distant past based on oral tradition. That's why in my Golden Rhinoceros, oral tradition takes almost no, have no place.
So we're talking about this book, The African Middle Ages, the 7th century to the 15th century, roughly. And you chose to use this term Middle Ages. And you talk a little bit about the choice of Middle Ages with regard to something like medieval or a term like pre-colonial. Can you reason through this decision with us?
Well, I think that talking about pre-colonial history is a problem because it put the emphasis on the period that would come later, you know, the colonial period, and I think there is a kind of, you know, there would be a kind of teleological, you know, reasoning in calling everything that took place before by the name of what took place later, and I don't like this expression of pre-colonial history, and I never use it actually. So I like the idea of speaking of ancient African history. And what I personally call ancient is before there were plenty of written sources. Because I think that the characteristics of ancient African history is precisely this lack of written sources and the specific challenge that it poses to paste together, you know, heterogeneous pieces of glass. And that's a specific challenge that makes African history so interesting in my view. And that's what I called ancient African history. But now, within this indistinctive ancient African history, I think there is a medieval period, which corresponds more or less to what we call the Middle Ages in European history, or what is called the medieval or classical period in the Islamic history. And it's not illegitimate to call this period of African history medieval, and I think that's perfectly fine. And because these societies, many societies in Africa, were connected with other medieval societies in the rest of the world, and so why not calling this connection between different provinces of the world the Middle Ages, And this is what I do. I'm not alone to do this. You know, I mean, there is a current of thought today that globalized the Middle Ages, and that tends to think of the Middle Ages as a global process, etc. There are many discussions about it, and there is this, you know, this global turn in the medieval studies. And all this is perfectly relevant. All this is absolutely fascinating. And I think that, yes, Africa has something to say. Because not only it is obvious that African societies participated in this process, but also because it's very interesting to rethink the Middle Ages. And thanks to what Africa bring, you know, into this new paradigm, it obliged to rethink, you know, what globalization was in the Middle Ages. It was obviously not the same sort of globalization as the modern one, but still, I mean, it was a kind of globalization, and it is all the more obvious when you look, for instance, at the way how medieval cartographers such as Idrisi represented the Ekumene, you know, and it was a global Ekumene, and it's also very interesting to read Ibn Battuta. Ibn Battuta's narrative of his travel in the along the global Ekumene, and including in different regions of Africa, and in that light, and I tend to think that precisely because cartographers like Idrisi were able to represent a global world, and precisely because travelers like Ibn Battuta or Jewish traveler Benjamin of Tudela or other travelers were able to travel almost everywhere at the cost of lying in many places to make us believe that they were everywhere, is very revealing in the sense that they all knew that the Ekumene was travelable, you know, but they were not completely able to do it. In other words, products, goods traveled and they knew it. Gold, you know, went from Zimbabwe to Europe, and slaves went from Kenya to China, and carnelian went from India to Ethiopia. And so things traveled, but people could not really. They could just feel, you know, they could just experience the completedness of the world, but they could not completely do it. And this contradictory feeling about the completedness of the Ekumene is, I think, a characteristic of the sort of globalization that the Middle Ages was. In other words, Middle Ages for me is not is as much a geography as a time period, and it is within this geography and time period that I try to draw the portrait of Africa as a partner of other provinces of the medieval world.
So let's have maybe a more concrete example for our listeners, because the book, as we've said, ranges quite far afield, all over the continent, and it's divided into these 34 kind of vignettes. And it's really a book that is exceptional for teaching, because these vignettes are short. Some are 3-4 pages, some are 6-7-8, a little longer, but they're each accompanied with just these beautiful illustrations. And then the citations and footnotes and all of that are kind of taken out and put in a short bibliographic essay at the end. So you can really focus on this exploratory process that you take us on. And I thought maybe we could linger for a second on chapter 23, which is called The Work of Angels. And it's about La Libella, which is this archaeological complex in the Ethiopian highlands. And if you're listening and you've never seen the Church of St. George at La Libella, Google it so that you see what this magnificent monument looks like. And I wanted to read a paragraph that describes it a little bit to give a sense of the lyrical quality of the language you have in this book. You say on page 155, "The Church of Georgis is not, strictly speaking, a building, since it was not constructed from pieces of stone or wood placed on top of one another. It has been hewn both inside and out, carved and hollowed out from the living rock. It displays no more joints than the tunic of Christ does seams. Great effort was expended to make the work of man invisible, to better celebrate the work of God." Such a beautiful paragraph.
Thank you, Elisa.
So tell us about the work of angels and the question at the heart of this complex.
What I wanted to convey, you know, in this chapter is not only that this site is wonderful, and deserve to be visited once in one's life, you know. it's an exceptional site, a complex of a dozen churches that are literally sculpted into the rock, and but at the same time, it's also exceptional because of the challenge that it posed to a historian. What do we do with the site which is sculpted? And not everybody understands this. You know, I've worked extensively in La Libella with other people, and we have sometimes tourists, okay, from Ethiopia or from Western countries or from Ethiopians living in other countries. Okay, so we have many sort of tourists that ask questions. And so what people don't understand is how challenging it is to work on this site, because it is so uncommon to have a site which is entirely sculpted. Think of the difference between this and a real archaeological site. An archaeological site is made of deposits, layers, okay? So basically the ruins of the 12th or 13th century site are below our feet. Okay, and then a number of layers that belong to the 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th centuries, okay, have been added to the soil, and we are working on it, and so we just have to excavate and to go through these different layers that are accumulated, and we can uncover the past, but it doesn't work with a complex that has been entirely excavated because the former layers has been removed by the very work of sculpting it. And so everything that was interesting in that, in everything that could help us document the people who made it has been removed by these people, okay, in the very process of creating these monuments and this complex. So what can we say about it? Not much. And so we are trapped by the discourse that were created in the past around this site. For instance, that it was created by angels in just a few days, or any other kind of hypothesis like this, whether it is created by the local people or by the religious people or by scholars. And how can we find our own way of reinterpreting the past? How can we and where can we find new sort of evidence? How can we do with this? And that's what I explain in this chapter about Lalibela, that we had to devise a kind of new vertical archaeology based on evidence that can still be observed, not beneath our feet, but above our head. And I cannot tell more, but you know, I give several examples in this chapter. We had to invent a methodology adapted to this site, and it worked. And now instead of being prisoner of past narratives in this, and instead of believing that it was created all of a sudden in the 13th century, now we know that this site was created and developed over several centuries, that it started before the 13th century, and that it continued to be transformed several centuries after the 13th century. So it's a much more complex representation, but also a much more interesting representation of the past. And you can, if I also can give you news about Sigil Massa. I've been working, and other researchers have been working at Lalibela, in Ethiopia. During the recent years, after the book was completed, and now we've discovered a new place that belonged to the 12th century, and there is in Lalibela a huge hill, which is actually a heap of spoils coming from the very sculpting of the churches in the 13th century. And so we hypothesized at some point that this hill could not be a natural hill, that it was an artificial mound. And if it was so, and if it was created in the 13th century, that meant that there was something below. And we were right, actually. So that we had now an entire pre-Christian complex that belongs to the 12th century, and that is currently being excavated, and that will eventually multiply the surface of the site of Lalibela, and the potential for further touristic visit of this wonderful site.
Well, that's just wonderful and exciting news, which we all need right now. So this is very encouraging, the powers of research showing us new ways forward. So as we kind of conclude, I wondered if you could tell us about the golden rhinoceros, the title of the book and one of the chapters of the book.
Yeah.
Why this object, why this title, and what is this golden rhinoceros?
Well, the reason why I chose this title, which, as you said, is just the title of one of the chapters, is because it captures, I think, the very idea of the connection of Africa with the rest of the world. I mean, the rhinoceros being an African animal, and gold being one of the most famous and valuable gold that circulated between Africa and the rest of the world. I mean, gold was basically the reason why Africa was known in the Middle Ages in the rest of the world. Think, for instance, of the Catalan Atlas, this famous map that was produced by Jewish cartographers in the 14th century in the Balearic Island. It represents King Musa of Mali with a huge gold orb in his hand. I mean, he was famous for exporting gold and toward the Islamic world and toward the rest of the world. So Africa was famous for gold, and so by associating gold and rhinoceros, I mean, I think this title captures the very connection between Africa and the rest of the world in the Middle Ages. Now, this golden rhinoceros comes, it really exists, and it comes from a site in today's South Africa, at the site of Mapungubwe, which is a hill that overlooks the Limpopo River, which draws the border between South Africa and Zimbabwe. And on the top of this hill was discovered in the 1930s by white settlers a hoard of gold. This with this rhinoceros and with a number of other things, etc. Basically, all this was found in graves, and it was looted by these people. And then, after a few days, one of the looters understood that it was wrong and wrote to his former history professors in Pretoria, who was Leo Fouché, and Leo Fouché understood very quickly that it was a major discovery. And then from then, the site has been excavated for decades, and now it's on the list of the World Heritage Site by the UNESCO. What is interesting is that we have a site at Mapungubwe, which is very far from everything else we know. Okay, it's very far from the site of the Swahili coast, etc. Obviously, the people that were buried there in the 12th century were not Muslim, were not Christians. Okay, they were buried, if only because they were buried with their riches, you know, gold, etc., which is generally not the case for Christians and Muslims. But still, they were connected with the rest of the world through the Islamic, through the Swahili merchants and through the Islamic merchants. How do we know this? Because in the graves, on top of the, besides the golden rhinoceros and other the golden objects, there were imports, such as a shard of Celadon ceramics that was produced in China, or Indo-Pacific beads by the thousands, etc., etc. So these people were well connected. In a way, they were at the end of the chain, the long chain of articulation and interconnection between Africa and the rest of the world. So that's a very good example of how an archaeological site can be an illustration of a connected place. But it's also very interesting. This site is also very interesting because of the history of how we know what we know, and that. This site was looted is a very common feature in many places in Africa. And very often we historians and we archaeologists, we have to deal with this. I mean, we have to deal with orphan objects. And so our job is first to start trying to reconstruct the way how this object arrived to us, you know, and many among historians of Africa work sometimes from objects that are in museums. And objects in museums are often objects which have been looted at some point in the past. And we have to work with it. It is also one of the conditions under which we work. But also the fact that the looters were white settlers, it also put the emphasis on the fact that there was a colonial period, and whereby white people had a privileged access to archaeological resources, symbolic resources, looting of the past, and which at the side effect of depriving local people of their own past and heritage. And all this is also, you know, all this colonial context is also part of how we deal with the history of ancient Africa. And we cannot forget it. We cannot obliterate part of this reality. And I cannot work at an archaeological site like Mapungubwe without acknowledging that this site was looted by white people 80 years ago, because this golden rhinoceros arrived to us both thanks to this looting and despite this looting. And this contradictory situation, this paradoxical situation, is in itself a metaphor of what it is to work on the past of African societies.
So, Xavier, thank you so much for taking the time to discuss this wonderful book.
Thank you very much, Elisa.